Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Try this on for a job description. Wanted: individual with sharp sense of humor, willing to devote endless hours listening to National Public Radio or the BBC. Someone who reads magazines and newspapers by the stack and watches television news for hours at a time. Someone with attitude. Okay, everyone, get in line behind me. But look a little further at the job description. It's clear it's not for everyone. We're talking about the work of editorial cartoonists this hour. These are the people who try to find a way to put humor and a knife's edge into the issue of the day. They live a working life with their toes on a line of propriety and taste and sarcasm. And they do it so we can have that aha moment when we crack open the morning paper to find our ideas or anger neatly drawn in a single box cartoon. This coming Monday, the Pulitzer Prizes will be announced, rewarding the people who are considered the best and helping us shape our opinions and thoughts. That includes reporters, writers, editors, and cartoonists. So today we'll take a look at the challenge of that art at a time when there's so much material to work with and so much at stake. Connection listeners, what do you look for in an editorial cartoon? Is there a line of decency or taste that shouldn't be crossed, or does that shift when nations are at war? Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us today is Steve Bell. He's the award-winning editorial cartoonist for The Guardian newspaper of London, joining us from the studios of the BBC. And David Horsey is also with us. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonist for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, and he's joining us from the studios of public radio station KUOW in Seattle. Thanks to both of you for coming in.
Happy to be here.
Hello.
Steve, let me start with you. Is it all war all the time these days at The Guardian?
I fear it is. I mean, it seems to have taken over everything. I suppose I'm starting to resent it, but on the other hand, it's just so sort of it's sort of hideously fascinating. So you can't sort of let it go, really. It just seems to go on, and it just seems to, well, from my point of view, it gets worse and worse. But you look at it another way, there's no shortage of material.
David, what about you?
I've started to feel like I'm working for a cable television news channel, because that's pretty much all I've been obsessed with for the last several weeks. Today's cartoon, I managed to get away from it, sort of, but not very far.
Well, look, we know you can draw, we know you're funny, but let's see how good you both are at describing what it is that you do. David, tell me about today's cartoon in the newspaper. What is it?
I was afraid you'd ask that, because it has a few more labels and things than I usually have. So it's a scene, it's actually a war scene. I have this group of sort of overweight soldiers loading a projectile into a howitzer, and they're aiming it at this city, but... The caption says, "Meanwhile, back in Washington, D.C., the elite Republican Guard takes aim at innocent civilians." And the soldiers in the front are the budget committee. The projectile they're loading into the howitzer, which is labeled Budget Buster, the projectile is the tax cut for the rich. And the city they're about to bomb are in the poorer sections of America, and the working poor, those dependent on school lunches and that sort of thing. So it's a happy little
this is,
step
this
away
is
the from
other
the war.
Republican Guard, the other Republicans.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly.
All right, terrific.
Which is what's going to inspire the letters to the editor.
Which is what you're supposed to do, isn't it? You're supposed to get somebody's dander up.
Exactly.
Steve, what have you got in The Guardian this morning?
Well, mine's a little less polite than Dave's. It's basically, the caption is... there is a role for the UN. This is after the war I'm talking about. And it's George Bush. He's sitting in I don't know how to describe it politely, but it's a, we say in the UK a shit house, but I mean a toilet. And the whole thing's sprayed with crap, and it's a complete mess. And he's reaching for the toilet paper, and the toilet paper is in the form of a roll of UN flags. Basically, that's the idea. It's the UN is going to clean up after. He's got to depend on the UN to clean up afterwards anyway. So the gist of the cartoon.
Just in case people might not be familiar with your George Bush, you do a George Bush with ears that come pointing straight out of the side of his head, like almost like rabbit ears going out sideways.
Yeah, he's got very low slung ears. That's something I've noticed about George Bush. I don't know what it is. I mean, I don't think I invented it. It's George Bush is very simian. He has a very sort of chimpanzee-like sort of attitude and sort of physique, and also body language, but also about his head. It's a definite sort of monkey-like. And his ears are very low slung. You look at George Bush's ears, they're way below, you know, normal person's ears. And I do tend to exaggerate, but then that's, I'm a cartoonist, for God's sake, I've got to do that.
What's the feature of the president's visage, David, that you try to highlight in your drawing of him?
Well, there are many, but probably the key for me is his eyes, these beady little squinty eyes that are pretty close set together. And I don't know, I guess the way, obviously, Steve and I are not big fans of the president, and so we tend to capture those physical elements that maybe reflect part of the attitude we perceive with the president. Or, you know, the same is true with any politician you deal with. You look for physical features that somehow express more than just, you know, the physical look, but get into something of the soul of the character.
There is something about his eyeballs that's important, because they are very, very close together. And in fact, I had an email from somebody, I think he was being sarcastic, but he said, couldn't you try getting his eyeballs any closer together? And that made me think, and so I ended up doing him with one big eyeball in the middle of his head. But I mean, that's
now, just so we're equal opportunity bashing here, I should let our listeners know that our web staff has spent hours pulling together a gallery of your work, Steve, yours, David, and that as we've been speaking, the image of the inside of the loo is also on the Connection site, as is the old budget buster. So people can test your descriptive acuity at the same time as they judge your work as cartoonist. But
right, in
down in the bottom of the bathroom, there are other characters, Steve.
Oh, there's Tony Blair on one side, buried up to his neck in crap, and on the other side is Saddam Hussein, also up to his neck. But he's in the form of a rat, so he's looking quite happy about things. But yeah, that's what happened.
Tell me, both of you, because these two countries that we're talking about are what people refer to when they talk about the coalition. Whether or not in your drawing of the prime ministers and presidents and descriptions of scenes behind the war, which is sort of more what you're doing, I would suggest. You have to be any more careful than you would be if you were in the middle of a political campaign and just slinging it around with the same old politicians. David, what about you?
Yeah, a little bit. And it depends on who you work for and where you work. Obviously, British newspapers have a different sort of standard. They're expected to be a little more, they are more partisan. So it gives you a certain amount of freedom, even in wartime. American newspapers tend to try to be, you know, having something for everyone. And in wartime, their sensitivities are heightened. I mean, I live in a city where it's sort of a liberal town, but we are surrounded by communities that are supported by military bases. So I know a certain segment of my readers out there have family who are, you know, getting shot at and shooting at others right now. So I think about that. And so I guess with cartoons I'm still critical on a political level, but I don't want to be misinterpreted as, you know, taking shots, you know, cheap shots at people in the military. You know, they're not my target in any way. They're not the people I disagree with. So I think about that. And other than that, I still feel as free as ever to criticize policy and criticize those making the policy.
Steve, what about from your office at The Guardian? Because the situation that Dave has described is very similar to yours, and that you know you'll have readers who are very supportive of the war and those who are very critical.
I suppose it's different here. I mean, I don't actually work at the Guardian. I always work from home. I live in Brighton, which is on the south coast, about 50 miles away from London. I never go into the Guardian. I send it all down the wire, generally. But I think the thing is, there's a generally, probably the majority opinion here, it's debatable. It's probably varying a little bit. It's probably it went down as the war started, but the majority opinion has definitely been against the war, so I don't feel any constraint about sort of hammering on in the same way. I mean, the fact that there are people out there who are under threat of death, it does give you pause for thought, but on the other hand, I think the best thing for these guys would be for them to come home, to end this ridiculous episode that's going on. I find it just a bit with an air of growing disbelief. I watch what's happening here, and the fact that all, you know, the whole post-World War II settlement just seems to have been trashed in the last couple of months. I mean, the United Nations has now been consigned to the waste bin. It really is quite worrying.
Let me ask you, Steve, to just comment on a cartoon that you sent in from your home on the 26th of last month. This is the two-panel box with Blair on one side saying, and I say this to the Iraqi people, we will not let you down. And then the other panel on the other side is your rendition of that horrible image of the 13-year-old Iraqi boy who had half of his head blown away. And down at the bottom, a little silhouette of Blair saying, but we might blow you up. We will not let you down, but we might blow you up.
Yeah.
That wasn't very funny.
No, it's not funny at all. It's just sometimes it's not. Sometimes, you know, a cartoonist, you find yourself being deadly serious in deadly earnest, and that's the way I think I feel. I think in this country, the UK and the US, I think we've got a very sort of cleaned-up view of war. People don't like to look at the nasty pictures. I think there was a spell of it in Vietnam, but they got over that, and they've swept them all under the carpet now, and they don't like looking at this nasty stuff and the horrible things that high explosives do, and they will carry on doing they. And yet the coalition forces, as they're called, are still throwing around cluster bombs and depleted uranium shells as if, you know, it doesn't matter at all. These are just things that you do. It's not right. It's not on. You know, this is nasty stuff that they're throwing around. They do nasty things to people. And it's, you know, children, people, ordinary people. You know, Baghdad is a city of what? How many million people? 6 million people or something. And what are all these hideous explosives are raining down from the sky? I mean, what's going on here? Why is it acceptable to do it over there? But you know, if it was happening over here, you know, people would start sort of making a very different noise about it.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about humor. We're also talking about anger, and we're talking about what we see when we open the morning paper in the editorial cartoons. Interesting observation that this coming Monday, the Pulitzer Prize will be awarded to the writers and reporters and the cartoonists in this country. And we're talking about the things that are in the minds of the people who dream them up and draw them. These days, our number 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, perhaps a word from you on what you're seeing, what you'd like to see, what you don't want to see in that particular box in your morning paper. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. In this hour, a conversation about the work of the editorial cartoonist at wartime. Steve Bell is with us from London. He draws for the Guardian newspaper. He is from London, though he doesn't live there. Steve Bell is with us. He draws for the Guardian newspaper. It's in London. David Horsey is Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonist for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. And we're introducing Robert Ariel now. He is the award-winning editorial cartoonist for the State newspaper in Columbia, South Carolina, and a devoted listener to The Connection, my spies tell me. Robert, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell me how you're dealing with that line these days. Are you putting it in a different place? Are you saying, no, I don't want to go there, I don't want to go this far?
I think a good cartoon should just grab you by the lapels and slap you around a bit. And so the line is always being pushed. And it's a shifting one as to how far can you go. But in this war, I have found that the best thing I can do is go after the enemy, Saddam. And he makes for a great caricature and cartoon subject.
I should get you to describe your morning cartoon, if you can do that for us.
Well, it's a take on embedded, and that's one of the buzzwords, and it's something that I like to do. All cartoonists do. I think we take a buzzword and then twist it. And in this case, Peter Arnett is embedded with the troops, only the troops are the Republican Guard, and they've dug themselves into a grave.
And the line is?
Embedded with the troops. Oh. This is Peter Arnett.
As if he were reporting.
Right.
Okay, I'm going to make sure that's up on our website as well. Robert, in your decision to go after the Iraqis, are you also deciding that you don't want to go after the president in the way that we're listening to Steve and David describing it earlier in the program?
No, because I truly do back the president on this, and I think my thinking changed after the events of September the 11th, and I think we do need a proactive, preemptive type of foreign policy now to take these people out before they use weapons of mass destruction against us.
Let's hear from David on this. I'm wondering, David, if you see yourself in any way as diminishing the president when you make him the butt of one of your cartoons.
Yes, it's true. I plead guilty. I mean, anytime any of us draws any particular public figure, our point is to diminish them, to satirize them, to ridicule them. And the reason is we disagree with them. I think most people understand what editorial cartoonists do, but not everybody. Some people think we're sort of like Jay Leno, and we're just making jokes about the news. But Steve or Bob or I do this because we believe certain things, and so that doesn't change with circumstances unless our opinions change. Bob would be untrue to himself if he were drawing cartoons that went against what he believed in, and same is true for me. This also, you mentioned earlier that cartoons come from humor and anger. Really, they mostly come from anger, and humor is just the weapon you use to express that anger. And so we have to be true to who we are. Occasionally I get a letter from a reader who says, well, why don't you give the other side? I think, well, somebody else can do that, but that's not my job. My job is to give my side and to stir up debate and to be provocative. And I'm not always right, but at the time I'm drawing, I think I am right.
Steve, have you ever done a cartoon that you regretted? Have you ever looked back a day or two or three and thought, whoa, I was in a dark space at that time. I shouldn't have done it? Or what are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I suppose I've been doing it a long time now, so I suppose I must have done over the years. I try to blot these things out. Usually it's the ones that don't work that you think, oh, that's no good. It's simply because it doesn't work as a cartoon. It's not funny, or it's just... it clunks, it falls flat. You think, well, I could have done that a different way. And you think, that's your failures. I can't think of an instance where I've been laying into somebody and I think, oh, I shouldn't have done that. He was really a nice guy. I should have left him alone.
Yeah.
I don't think so. It's because your views are fairly sort of, I've got fairly strong views, and I'm not going to sort of, as David suggests, I mean, if your views change, you'll change your outlook. But I mean, it's not the sort of thing you do overnight kind of thing. So it's mainly, you know, if you let a dud cartoon get through, you think, oh, that was bad, you know.
Bob Ariel, how involved in the drafting of the cartoons as the newspaper's editor? Are you pretty well left to your own devices here?
Fortunately.
I'm very fortunate in that respect. I don't actually work at the paper. I work in, like, 50 miles away, and I send stuff down the line. And I always send it at the last minute, so they've got to use it, unless there's something really badly wrong with it.
Let me hear if I can from Bob on this. Bob.
Yes, my editor is great, the best editor for an editorial cartoonist to have, I think, because not only can he help me actually improve an idea in a cartoon, he thinks like a cartoonist, and he pretty much just gives me free rein to do my job.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's hear from some of the people who look at the cartoons now. Alan's on the line from Boston. Hi, Alan.
Hi.
Thanks for calling in.
Good. Is this Steve?
It's Dick, actually. Go ahead.
Oh, hi, Dick. Well, I just wanted to say that as to, you know, what limits to recognize, I guess you have to respect the propriety of the audience. You know, the daily papers are often used in classrooms and things like that. But as to political content and social content, I think it's an incredibly powerful part of chronicling our times. I remember being a student, even a young student, as a college student, trying to read about history, get assigned 100 pages. But if you were lucky, you'd get a cartoon in the middle of the textbook that would be so much more powerful as a catalyst to your understanding. And you'd think, wow, geez, this thing's from 1930. I guess they weren't so stupid. And I don't think that's going to be less important as time goes on in this information age where there's so much. There's just a volume of data.
As a matter of fact, just a week or so ago, Alan, I was flipping through a book, and it had somebody's editorial cartoon of the fellow who at the time was General Secretary of the Communist Party in the Soviet Union, Yuri Andropov, and he was holding the South Korean airliner that, I don't know if you remember, the Soviet Union shot it down, killing some 200 people. And his fingers were dripping with blood, and he was kind of holding this aircraft in his hand like a child would hold a toy. And it came back from the past so strongly. That, I mean, it's a good illustration of what you're talking about, that these cartoons, well done, really do illustrate history.
Very catalytic and very dense in their meaning. And I think it's going to become more and more important because sifting through data to make sense and make information requires these kind of dense catalytic symbols or other, you know, other kinds of media. And with the web, it's going to be easier to get images spread out. It's going to be important to add to the text, the reams and reams of which is now available. So, you know, and I think, you know, as to political views, it's just as important for me to hear from other sides and from cartoonists who disagree with me and who I would, you know, have an animated discussion at a party with. I want to hear from all of them. Just as important. And as to limits, generally push them, especially when it gets closer and closer to purely political matters.
Are you a cartoonist yourself, Alan?
Just a verbal cartoonist.
Okay. Thanks a lot for calling in. It was nice to have you on the program. I know that Steve, David, and Robert, you're all you know, you will all take collections of the cartoons that you do and put them into books. And Robert, yours, I gather your latest one, Ariel, was one of the top-selling books in South Carolina.
It was.
Is there something about the history to that? I mean, the way that Alan's describing how we can mark our time with a daily window cartoon.
I really think so. Even though they're, you know, we're dealing in hyperbole and we're really stretching the truth, there is truth in the cartoons. And when you look at them from many years later, you can learn about the time by looking at cartoons, just like you were looking at that older cartoon about Andropov. I think you can get a good sense of the zeitgeist of the time by looking at collections of cartoons.
And David, in the last little while, we've seen some of the old work of Bill Malden.
Yeah.
I always reverse those two letters. Yeah. Who was the Second World War cartoonist, so highly regarded, who died just a couple of months ago.
Oh, absolutely. And, of course, he was, I suppose, and maybe he was the first embedded journalist in a way, but, I mean, he was so close to the, when you consider his World War II cartoons, so close to the action that he had a profound and amazingly special voice because of that. But he really carried that attitude that infuriated General Patton into his work for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and I think it was Chicago Daily News. He was kind of an imp as a 21-year-old GI, and he continued that way through his life. We're all imps as cartoonists.
The two characters, Willie and Joe. Steve, I'm looking at one of his old ones, and they're sort of tucked down behind a ridge, and the caption is, Must be a tough objective. The old man says we're going to have the honor of liberating it. It just, I mean, things don't change, I suppose. But what about the history side of it, Steve, from your perspective?
I very much echo what the other two guys have been saying. It's, I mean, I remember when I was studying history at school and it'd be acres and acres of really boring text. And then it'd be lit up by in my case, it was a cartoon by David Lowe, who was a cartoonist who was very well known in the UK in the 20s and 30s and 40s, especially during the war. Mm-hmm. He did the most classic cartoon, I think, which summed up the very moment of, it was the German invasion of Poland and the Nazi-Soviet pact. And it's got Hitler and Stalin greeting each other over the dead body of Poland. It's called Rendezvous. It's the most absolute classic. And I just remember seeing it. I think, God, that says it all. And there weren't many cartoons in the book, but it stuck in your mind and just made you think, yeah, there's something else there. There's something. And yes, it does. You look back on old stuff and it does give you a flavour of the time and a flavour of how people think and how. Also, just the current prejudices and everything that's going on, and also the current fashions. And yeah, I think it's a great medium.
Bob Ariel, I wonder if you remember the Malden cartoon that was done on the day after Kennedy's assassination.
Yes, it's one of the great cartoons of the 20th century. And
describe it for us.
Well, if I'm thinking of the right one, it was of the Lincoln Memorial, and the statue of Abraham Lincoln is. His head is bowed and his hand covering his face. He's weeping at the assassination of John F. Kennedy.
And there's no caption at all.
It was a powerful, very powerful cartoon.
1-800-423-8255. Let's go now to Bob, who's calling in from Governor New York. Hi, Bob.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. My concern with what we're talking about is... the degree of how far, you know, you were talking about how you were portraying the president, making his eyes come close, so close that they're one eye and super pointed ears. I really read these cartoons and a lot, and it seems like he takes worse hits than Saddam or anybody, you know. I'm wondering if you're shooting yourself in the foot by going too far in that direction, because I don't think you're getting the desired effect from a certain part of the population.
You mean you end up making him look like a hero hitting him too hard?
Well, yeah, that plays too. But also, you know, I automatically think, what kind of guy writes this kind of stuff or draws these kind of things?
Well, you're talking to one right now, David Horsey. Go ahead.
Well, I understand what you're saying, but I suspect you might have loved the cartoons I did about Bill Clinton. And again, there are about 100, maybe 150 editorial cartoonists in the United States, and they draw from all sorts of different political perspectives. And our job isn't to reflect all perspectives. Each one of us has our own perspective. And I think if you looked at all the cartoons being done, all the voices are out there. And I realize, obviously, the cartoons I do are going to make a certain number of people mad who happen to disagree with me. But I think it has more to do with where you are in the political spectrum as to what you like. I've had some people who loved me while Clinton was president who aren't real happy with me now. But I haven't changed. The president changed, or the man in the office changed, and suddenly I'm goring somebody else's ox.
you have a point there. You really do with Bill Clinton, but I assume the whole idea is you're trying to change the way people think, you know. And if you go too far, like you brought up Bill Malden, now he was great, and there was some kind of, I don't know, passion or pathos or something about the way he did it that it you saw the point, but it didn't go too far in the area of disrespect. For the powers that be, and
let's hear from Steve Bell on this. As to Steve, do you see what you're doing as changing people's minds?
I think it would be silly to think you're trying to change people's minds. Obviously, you're trying to put your own point of view, But if you're expecting to change people's minds, then you're on a hiding to nothing. You're not. What you're trying to do is express your point of view as well as possible. Now, there's no point in me suddenly doing a backflip and expressing a contrary point of view, because I wouldn't believe it. It wouldn't come out well. It would be, you know, it might fit in with the gentleman caller, you know, his views, but it wouldn't be any good from my point of view. I'm trying to make the best job I can of expressing, if you like, my side of the argument. And, you know, the way I see it, George Bush is all the things that, you know, I'm being critical and I'm belittling him. I'm sure I am. Yeah, he's a... You know, you look at it, you've got to look at the guy from the perspective of the rest of the world. And I don't think people in America quite understand how what a public relations disaster George Bush is. I mean, what comes across in George Bush is A, his stupidity, and B, his arrogance. And this is across the board over here. I think you got the way he talks. You've got this sort of sub-Churchillian kind of rhetoric, which is really bad and it doesn't work properly. And then he's got a very poor way of expressing himself. And then he's got the pure, pure arrogance of what he's actually saying, which is that we'll do what we want and screw the rest of the world. That's sort of summing it up in a nutshell. All right, I'm brutally caricaturing it, perhaps, but...
I better hear from Bob Arias.
Well, I think it's confidence, and I think he's a man that knows where he's going and has a vision. And he's not leading by polls. He's taking a position that is condemned around the world, although I think it's majority of Americans support him, I believe, although there are people here that disagree. But
I think
the anti-war movement is mostly an anti-Bush movement.
Does that mean, Bob, that you don't put the president in the cartoons in any form?
Oh, yes, I do.
Yeah, you do.
And I draw him as a humorous caricature. I don't think that any of my caricatures are flattering to anybody, but I put them in positions that are not demeaning to him. Now, you know, that's because that's the way I feel about him. But
you'll still do what editorial cartoonists do and pick out those features of his face that you have to highlight.
I do, and I make he has a rather large forehead and a little pointy nose, and the eyes are rather closely set together.
We're going to talk a little bit further about editorial cartooning and the controversies over that when we come back after the break. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. All right, write this down, www.theconnection.org. Go there today and see a terrific gallery of editorial cartoons by some of the best working. Right now we have the work of Bob Arias there from the State newspaper in Columbia, South Carolina, David Horsey's work from the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, and Steve Bell's drawing and humor from the Guardian newspaper in London. Connection listeners, we're taking your calls at 1-800-423-8255 about what it is they do these days, because these days are different days. We're going to start with Mark in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hi, Mark.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, thanks for calling in.
Great. Well, I had a question, sort of general one. First of all, as a Canadian living in the United States, I've really appreciated Steve Bell's work, and I've been going to the Guardian, you know, downloading things and enjoying those. But I had a question for all of the cartoonists, and it relates to something that I was thinking of in relationship particularly to Bob. And that is, Bob, as somebody who works in Columbia, South Carolina, which is a city with a very large military presence,
right?
I was wondering how that impacted on your cartooning. You know, you have a national audience, but also a local one. And I was very interested in hearing from all of you how that local community affected your, what I'll call, freedom of expression, so to speak.
Okay, Mark, let's start with Bob on that one.
Well, I think, first of all, I'm a product of my community. I was born here in Columbia, South Carolina. Grew up in Miami, but moved back, and my father was in the military, stationed here at Fort Jackson. So the locale where you come from has a lot to do with how your opinions are formed. This is a rather conservative community, and although I think of myself as a little bit right of center, there are plenty of people here that think I'm a raving liberal. So it just shows you there are different levels of perception.
Steve Bell, do you draw for a global audience now, knowing that people like Mark are checking you out on the web?
Well, it's nice to know that somebody as far away as over there is seeing the stuff. I work. It's slightly different in Britain because, I mean, there are lots of national papers, so you're working for the whole of the UK. Which extends from the south, which is where I am in Brighton, all the way up to the north of Scotland. And there's a slight difference here in that there are local papers, but they tend to be, you know, very local, and a lot of them don't tend to have cartoonists, really. But then the national papers have all got cartoonists, so we're all, I suppose, pitching to a national audience. The papers here tend to be, people look on The Guardian, oh, that's a liberal paper, which is true, it is a liberal paper. It's been a liberal paper since about 1827 or whenever it's been going. But most of the papers tend to be more to the right. I'm thinking of things like The Times, The Daily Mail, Daily Express.
Does that mean they wouldn't publish your stuff?
Yeah, no, there's no other paper that would touch me with a barge pole, to be honest. No. So I'm not really pitching towards a local audience. I'm obviously pitching towards people who live in the same area as me, or to read The Guardian, but it's not quite the same. We're not doing local issues.
All right, David Horsey, you mentioned earlier that you've got that combination of the liberal side of Seattle as well as the people within range of the newspaper who are members of military families with kids, brothers,
right.
Overseas. Tell
USS
me.
Lincoln, for instance, is based just north of Seattle, so it's an interesting combination.
Does it mean you get a lot of nasty email?
Actually, not all that much. I can think of my audience in various levels. I can think of, you know, but the primary readership is in Seattle, which is, you know, the town of WTO. It's you know, a very liberal city. But the region around is much more conservative. Then I have 250 newspapers that my cartoons go to, and they're all over the place. So it finally comes to a point where I can't worry about it. I just have to continue to do what I do. And if I get hate mail from, you know, South Carolina, for instance, and that's too bad. But which I have, as a matter of fact. I had some guy from South Carolina who didn't like one of my cartoons and challenged me to meet him somewhere to duke it out.
Was that you, Bob?
Yeah, it may have been. But but I find that even though I suppose my views reflect Seattle relatively well, it's just as easy to offend folks on the left. In fact, maybe easier.
Oh, I think a lot easier.
They expect me to be on their side. And when I'm not, it's a real betrayal, whereas a more conservative person is happy with any crumb I throw them.
Can you think of one where that happened? I don't know whether or not I'm springing that on you, but...
Where which happened?
Where you got
which
under
side?
The... Yeah, you sort of annoyed the Starbucks crowd too much.
Yeah, actually it was during the at the beginning of the war in Afghanistan, and I did, some of the instant anti-war reaction was just like a flashback for these guys to 1969 or something, and it didn't have a whole lot to do with the issues at hand. So I did a couple of cartoons that lampooned the peace movement, and that did stir up the Birkenstocks in town. So.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Mark, thanks for that. Next to Burlington, Vermont, David's on the line. Hello, David.
Yeah, I just would like to applaud, first of all the comic artists out there. I really think that, art in all of its forms is the most effective way of communicating both dissent and support and as well as overall socio-political commentary. So I applaud those. I especially applaud those who exercise their dissent. But I have a question. For all the artists on the show, about some of the less mainstream artists, and have you viewed their work? And when I say this, I speak of
it's what we used to call the underground comics, and now they're the web, the sort of blog comics. Is that fair?
Yeah, I guess you could say that. and I don't know if I can drop names of those.
Drop a name. Go ahead. We do it all the time on this show.
But, like, you know, Aaron Magruder, I know he's had some stuff in the Times, the New York Times, and, like, David Rees, Tom Tomorrow, people like that, who do these sort of, they definitely exercise their dissent in their comics. And, you know, how do the comics on the show, how have they experienced censorship? How do they feel, should there be censorship in the artist's industry there?
Let's not make it a censorship thing, but rather hear from them about the importance or the role of the comics who would, you know, kill for the opportunity to take over the office now occupied by Ariel or Horsey or Steve Bell. Steve, maybe you can start here. The comics that David's describing here, are they an important part of your work?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's good to see a whole range of stuff. I mean, I'm not too well up on the ones he mentioned. I mean, I've heard of Tom Tomorrow, for instance, and I've heard of Aaron Magruder, who he does a strip. What's it called?
Boondocks. I mean.
Boondocks. That's right. Yeah, that's the syndicated strip. So I've seen that. Yeah, I mean, this is all, and it's coming from a different side of the field, isn't it? And it's good to see that. Also, people like Ted Rawl and also Clay Bennett and. Who you don't tend to hear so much about, but who are really sharp and really on the ball. And I suppose I like them because they're sort of echoing my own views. But there's a lot of stuff out there, and there's a lot of people saying things. And I suppose you wonder about this question of a mainstream. I don't tend to like to look in terms of alternative. You know, there is an alternative comic world. I think there's we're all in the same mainstream, as it were. Just you know, some of it gets more airtime than others. But
David, tell me in your perspective whether or not you think the web has changed the access or what's the word I'm looking for, the audience for these cartoonists.
I think it started to, but I don't see a lot of. That's still such a small niche. I don't think it's done a whole lot. You know, the pool these folks swim in, it tends to be the alternative, the city weeklies, and they've really taken it over. But I think they're starting to seep into mainstream. I know our newspaper just started to use Ted Rawls cartoons, for instance. Of course, you can get away with that in Seattle, but. You know, if Steve Bell was working here, he'd never get a job at a mainstream American newspaper. He'd be working for the Village Voice or the Seattle Stranger or something like that. So the standard hasn't shifted a whole lot in this country yet. But the alternative, as we call them, I don't know why they're alternative, but just because they don't get published by big newspapers. But
they're underpaid, that's what it means.
Yeah, they're underpaid, that's it. I mean, I find them a real challenge to me because I think they're doing some great work and I think, okay, can I be that fresh? Can I be that different?
That's an interesting point, Bob. Do you look at the work that other people are doing to see whether or not on that day you got the zeitgeist just the way you wanted it?
Well, I do get to look at the ones that we get through syndication.
Right.
And a lot of times I'll be working on an idea and I have to trash it because somebody's already hit it. And it does I think... One that was really amazing, at least I thought it was amazing, but about 25 cartoonists around the country in the same news cycle. We all drew it on September 11th, and we all did it the day of with showing the Statue of Liberty bowed with her hand covering her face, not unlike the Lincoln mm-hmm. cartoon by Malden. And, you know, I thought I'd hit a pretty good lick there, and... turns out I was about 25 cartoonists, I found out, did the same thing.
Least. Well, that's good company. I mean, that's one way of looking at it.
Yeah, but you want to be
original
and sometimes you only have certain images to work with. New York, you know, the Statue of Liberty is a big symbol there, and that's why we all hit on that. But I try to be fresh and original, and I do try to look at work after I've done what I'm doing so that I'm not influenced before I do it.
David Horsey, tell me in your view whether or not you think the work that you're doing today is in any way different from the work that might have been done in the Second World War or 50 years before that. And I guess I'm looking for a sense from you people who are doing this day to day whether or not political cartooning itself has changed.
Well, if you're talking about the Second World War or even the First World War, yeah, it's changed dramatically, but it reflects a bit of society's different attitude. We've gone through Vietnam, and that's changed everything. And we also live in a time when there is not the common view of America and America's place in the world that existed in 1941 or 1917 simply isn't there anymore. Although in some ways it was rekindled with September 11th attack. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, I think during World War II, I think it'd be very rare to see any critical cartoons of the president. And I suppose that was true in World War I too, but that's, we now have a generation of baby boomers and Gen Xers drawing cartoons. And we've all got, for better or worse, a bit more of an attitude and a lot more skepticism.
Steve Bell, let me hear from you. And you can actually leave yourself out of this equation if you want. But just talk about whether or not you think there is less reverence in political editorial cartooning today.
In some ways, there isn't. I think in another way, though, it's become the other way. It's, I think, a lot of political cartoons are much tamer than they used to be. I mean, I'm thinking perhaps if you go way back to, like, Cruikshank, Gilray, those sort of people, they were really wild, these guys. They were doing stuff that I wouldn't dare try on. And this was back in, like, the early years of the 19th century. I don't know. I sometimes... I think cartoonists, we can get a bit sort of hung up on, you know, not offending people, and it can sort of... it can be detrimental to what you're trying to do. I think if you try, you can't. The thing is, you can never please everybody. There's no way you're going to please it. You're always going to put somebody's nose out, because that's the nature of the game. It's politics, and people care deeply about it, and they either care one way or they care the other way. And this, you know, sooner or later, you're going to get up somebody's nose big time.
Listen, we're out of time. I want to thank all of you for being with us. Steve Bell, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Steve's an editorial cartoonist for The Guardian newspaper. David Horsey, thanks for getting up early to join us on this.
Absolutely. It's great fun.
David's editorial cartoonist for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. And Robert Ariel, thanks so much for joining us on the line.
Thank you for having me, Dick.
Bob is editorial cartoonist for the State newspaper of Columbia, South Carolina. Connection listeners, a reminder, check out our guests or collection of cartoons on our website at theconnection.org. Special thanks to Herta Weikricht in London for help with the program today, and Susan Qualls in Seattle. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.